Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how proposed cuts to the SNAP program could impact Arizonans.
And a renewed debate about the dangers of blending religion and politics.
But first, a Maricopa County Superior Court judge has ruled state lawmakers violated the state constitution's gift clause a couple of years ago when they approved sending more than $15 million to a group that runs the Prescott Frontier Rodeo. The cash came at the request of two area lawmakers. With me to talk about the ruling and what it could mean for talks on the new state budget is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, how did we get to this point where a court is ruling on whether or not the state can spend money on the Prescott Rodeo grounds?
Well, back in 2023, when they were adopting the budget, the state was flush with cash. And so they decided, well, we can either spend it on new programs or some one-time expenditures, or we can let everyone else decide within the legislature how they want to spend it. And that included the governor. So, for example, the governor went ahead and decided to spend her money, pool her money along with that of some Democrats for some housing trust funds. Some Republicans had their own particular ideas. We got a few roundabouts and pavings. This one involves two Prescott area lawmakers who said, you know, the Prescott Rodeo grounds need to be fixed up. And so we're going to allocate $15.3 million to an organization that runs the rodeo, the Prescott Frontier Days, so that they can use it to go ahead and fix up the fairgrounds. Sounds good. Everybody was getting their share. Until a couple of folks who live up there, including a former Superior Court judge, said, wait a second. You're giving state money to a private organization for a private purpose. And there's a provision in the Constitution that says you cannot make a gift of state funds. And generally speaking, there is a two-pronged test for that. Number one, does it serve a public purpose? Number two, does the state or the taxpayers get something commensurate in return? So, for example, school districts will use their money to pay some private organization, let's say for tutoring, if it's an area that they cannot do. Again, it's a public purpose, and they're getting something in return, i.e. a service. In this case, the judge said, no, it fails on both counts. There's no public purpose here, and there's nothing commensurate that the taxpayers are getting in return. And so we have the ruling that says, that's it, you cannot do that. And now we decide, does the money just go back into the general fund or what?
Well, so yeah, what happens to that money? Do we have a sense of that yet?
Well, for the moment, the money goes back into the general fund. Now, there are some measures out there. Senator Fincham and Representative Wynn have some thoughts about, well, maybe there's another way to get the money to the cause. In other words, give it to the city of Prescott for certain public purposes, and then they can go ahead and use it for the fairgrounds. Now, where the line is between that and giving it directly to the Prescott Frontier Days is a little tricky on a legal perspective, but they think they can make it work. Of course, they thought they could make the first one work, so, you know, put two attorneys in the room, I'll give you six different opinions as to whether something is legal. And this all comes as we're trying to adopt a budget for the new fiscal year that begins on July 1st. And there is some surplus there. And my guess is somebody will look for a way to put money for various public and or private purposes, because we know that there is some sort of excess, although we don't even know how much. And we're not even sure that the House and Senate Republicans among themselves agree on how that should be divided up.
Howie, let me get to that in just a second, but I want to go back to the gift clause. And this is obviously not the first case in which judges have had to sort of sort out whether an appropriation or some kind of policy violates the gift clause. How does this ruling sort of fit in with some of the other recent ones on that issue?
Well, there's a whole series of cases, as you point out, that suggest there is a line there. For example, the city of Phoenix was paying union members in some of their unions to work on union business on city time on the city payroll. And the court said, no, that is a gift. The city argued, well, there's a public purpose because it means for for more smooth relations with the union, and the courts weren't buying that. We had years ago, going back to 2010, a deal where City North was building a garage and they were using public funds because they said, well, the public will get to use some of these spaces. And the court said, no. More recently, we have the Arizona Commerce Authority. You may remember these CEO forums that they do. These go where they're inviting top people from corporations around the state to come to the Super Bowl, come to the Waste Management Open, and we will wine you and dine you and show you a good time because we think that maybe you'll bring your company here. And that didn't go to court because Attorney General Chris May stepped in and said, you do that again, and I'm going to haul your tushes into court. And they backed down, and now they're using private funds. We also had a fight over the Omni Hotel in downtown Tempe about who is building that, who's building the parking garage. Again, same sort of thing as City North. That one ended up getting settled out of court with some sort of agreement. But there's a long history of saying, here are the guidelines. What don't you understand?
So, Howie, let's get back to this year's budget, which, of course, starts for the fiscal year starting on July 1st. And there's been some talk, as you have and others have reported, that the Senate specifically is looking at some kind of similar idea as a couple of years ago, where different entities get a certain amount of money that they can do with what they want.
Exactly. The Senate believes that there's going to be about $270, $280 million of surplus. Now, that's fascinating because the Democrats say we're $1.7 billion in the red. Depends on what you say has to be included. Mm-hmm. But assuming, let's say, $270 million, you take $90 million and you divide it up three ways. Senate Republicans get $90 million, House Republicans get $90 million, and then the governor and the Democrats get $90 million. Of course, you know, the Democrats are the minority, although, again, the governor is involved in this. That idea isn't flying really over with the House Republicans. Part of it is the question of what should we fund with our little mini slush funds, if you want to call them that. For example, there is a need, I think it's pretty well documented, for pay raises to keep DPS employees from going to other agencies. Should that be left to the governor to use out of her fund, or is that a basic state function? And so that quote unquote surplus isn't as large. You know, there are issues in terms of how much of the housing trust fund, should that be the governor's or someone else's? Should there be a rebate like several Republicans did several years ago? Or is that something that we should look at? For example, there's some ballot measures to actually lower the state income tax rate anytime we have a structural surplus. And so here we are at 9:06 a.m. Más o menos on June 2nd saying, we got a budget to get out by July 1st, actually probably earlier because some lawmakers are leaving town before then. How do we put this together? Now, will it happen? It always has. One year we did get into July 1st, although everybody sort of squinted and the state government did not shut down. But you know, the deadline is approaching, and it's amazing how much a deadline, as you and I know, being in journalism,
yes,
the editor yelling, deadline, and suddenly, you know, everything clears up and we can get a story out.
Certainly lots to come in the weeks ahead. All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you so much as always.
Have a great morning.
The U.S. Senate this week is expected to start work on the budget bill approved by the House last month, and some senators say they're hoping for changes to what has been dubbed the Big Beautiful Bill. Among many other provisions, the measure would cut billions of dollars for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. This is the program commonly referred to as food stamps. It's currently funded by the federal government, but the House version would force states to cover part of it by 2028. With me to talk about what these changes could mean for SNAP and recipients is January Contreras, President and CEO of Children's Action Alliance. January, good morning.
Good morning, Mark, and thanks for bringing attention to this issue.
Of course, thank you for being here. So let's start with, like, how many Arizonans use SNAP? How prevalent is this program here?
So SNAP, which again, it's assistance for groceries. These are folks who are not going to be able to fill the refrigerator without this assistance. It's almost 1 million people in Arizona, which was a surprise to me, even as I had to learn more about this looking at this budget.
So what would it potentially mean if, for example, Arizona was going to have to cover some of the costs of this? Like, is there any indication the state can or would do that?
You know, I think it's hard to say this is what would happen. But the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan entity, is saying, yes, we can predict there will be states who are not able or who don't choose to come up with a state match. And so suddenly, it is possible that you could have the state legislature, for some reason, we get extra money, they decide to raid the rainy day fund, you know, those things that keep the program there. But the truth is, we already have budget issues, and it is a real threat to the program if the state match has to be changed in this monumental way in such a short amount of time as this bill demands.
Are there estimates in terms of how many Arizonans could potentially lose their benefits, at least under the plan that the House has approved?
Yeah. I mean, if we look at this, we're looking at, across the country, $1.3 million people losing their assistance, 3.2 million Americans losing just based on the other details that are in that bill when it comes to SNAP. So this is a lot. And again, the state is going to be in the position of either having to drastically reduce what these benefits are. And we're talking, you know, $180 a month is what, you know, a person is going to get with these groceries.
Less than $200 a month for food.
I mean, we're not talking about a lot of money here. And especially when you look at the rising cost of groceries, you look at the rising cost of housing, of childcare, of car insurance, it's really tough for folks to make it. So the timing of this is particularly painful.
So let's talk about what the impacts could be. And again, we should point out, this is what was in the House passed version. It still has to go through the Senate. And there are some senators who have said, among other provisions they don't like, this is one of them. But for sake of argument, if some number of Arizonans lose their SNAP benefits, like, what does that mean for them? And what are sort of the ripple effects of that?
There are a lot of ripple effects. You know, yesterday in church, we were asked to pray for senior citizens, for the elderly. And the first thing that came to my mind was this bill and the loss of grocery assistance. There's a lot of senior citizens. There's a lot of veterans. One in five kids are facing food insecurity. So when you think about the ripple effects, the intended or the unintended consequences, it's big. We will have folks, senior citizens who are on a fixed income, who will not be able to have enough to eat, who will be hungry. We will have kids in school who, you know, by the way, school meals is tied to how many kids are on SNAP.
Mm.
So we won't only have kids losing that food security in their own home. We'll have kids also, some of them will also have their school meals impacted. So that's their ability to thrive in school, right? We're a children's organization, Children's Action Alliance. We want kids to have all of the things that they need to thrive. And this part of this bill really moves it in the wrong direction.
I mean, there have been a lot of studies that suggest that kids who are not, for example, well-fed, who are hungry, are not able to learn and not able to be at their best in schools. It sounds like that's kind of what you're talking about. But I assume it also applies to adults as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're talking about kids, absolutely. They need to have food in their stomach to do their best in school, to learn, for brain development, right, for their own development. And when it comes to adults of any age, actually, SNAP is tied to helping people get to work. If you look at some of this research, it's tied to lower costs through health insurance because they are healthier individuals. So there's a lot that, you know, so many of us take for granted that we can buy. Maybe we're buying generic brands instead of the brands we love at the grocery store. But for a lot of people, that's not the reality. It's either, you know, they're buying 10 items or they're buying 5 items. And that's a real tough reality.
Is there room to adjust SNAP? I mean, a lot of folks are talking about, you know, sort of the buzzwords fraud, waste, and abuse in not necessarily in SNAP, but in other, you know, Medicaid and other programs that some Republicans are looking to adjust. Are there changes that could be made to SNAP that would be okay in your mind?
I mean, sure. Look, good government is what we all want, and we want our dollars to be stretched so that they're going to the real needs of Americans, of Arizonans. I will say in this moment, and I'm a former healthcare fraud prosecutor, right? there are people out there and there are organizations, quite frankly, that are out there to make money off of government services. That's true here in Arizona. We've seen it. It's true everywhere. But these are the individual people that are getting tagged with, you know, being the greatest perpetrators of waste, fraud, and abuse. It's not. These are people who are doing their best to make it day to day. We always have room to bring integrity to government services. We should. That's our responsibility. But the way that that term of preventing fraud, waste, and abuse right now is being used to really take away from the lowest earners of this country, people who are struggling every day but making it, barely making it, and we're using this term waste, fraud, and abuse to instead, really, this bill is about a lot of tax cuts for the highest earners. It's being misused. We can, in fact, go after fraud, waste, and abuse. And a lot of times that's going after, you know, folks who are very sophisticated and are in that highest earner category. So it takes really approaching that with a sense of honesty to say, let's go look at who really is perpetrating the most fraud, waste, and abuse, because we can get those guys.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. January Contreras, President and CEO of Children's Action Alliance. Thanks so much, January. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how to spark creativity by asking, what if?
So what if allows for possibilities beyond this time and space, beyond any form, beyond an office, beyond buildings?
Why one author says it's essential to allow creativity in the workplace.
But first, many political observers have noted a renewed religious fervor on the right wing of American politics. And according to sociologist Dr. Ruth Braunstein, much of that energy is being cultivated right here in the Valley. Braunstein recently released a serialized podcast investigating the resurgence of Christian nationalism. The show takes a close look at the ideological and spiritual debates unfolding at two Phoenix churches, Desert Springs Bible Church and Dream City Church, which has a long-running affiliation with the right-wing advocacy group, Turning Point. I spoke with Dr. Braunstein recently about her series.
The reason that we were at Dream City Church was because Turning Point hosts a monthly event called Freedom Night that really is led by Charlie Kirk, a political operative, not a pastor, who plays the role of a pastor on that night at church.
I do not believe that if you love the Lord, read the Bible, and call yourself a Christian, that you can vote for Kamala Harris for president of the United States. I do not believe that is possible.
You know, we've been having conversations in American politics about the influence of faith organizations on the right in particular, going back at least as far as the George W. Bush administration and even farther. But this seemed really different to you.
It did. And in part because I think that there's a real stark difference between conservative Christians voicing their opinions in politics and public life and promoting the idea that everybody else is demonic, and therefore we've reached a level of catastrophe that requires a non-democratic takeover of the country and a sense of catastrophe and crisis that is being used to justify the takeover of power outside of democratic channels. And then that it was being kind of repeated back to us by regular people, in the course of explaining why these issues were important to them and why they're so concerned, really to me showed the extent to which, you know, it's working.
Why am I here tonight? Because I'm a Christian. This is a church that we come to and we brought our children to. Because I love the United States of America, and I see that I see and know what is happening.
One of the other main characters in this story is Caleb Campbell, who's the pastor at Desert Springs Church, also here in Phoenix. We've actually had Caleb on this very show. And he talks about being called Marxist, which is a charge that gets leveled against a number of people in the show who don't toe the hard right political line. And in a literal sense, obviously, Marxist doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because it's not like
Caleb or these other folks are espousing the beliefs of Karl Marx. But it's emblematic of something deeper, it seems like, in the culture.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a media story in so many ways. And I can't tell you how many times we heard from or read accounts of local pastors who used almost the same image to describe the plight that they faced, which was, we have people's attention for an hour once a week on Sunday. And for all of the other time during the week that they are plugged into something, right, they're listening to these other messages, often from right-wing media figures, influencers, often explicitly Christian influencers online, who are having now an outsized influence on what they would call their political discipleship. And so it's a lot for, in 1 hour on a Sunday, a pastor to be able to either counterbalance or untangle in some way. And a lot of the messages that they're hearing in that right-wing media space is the idea that, A, the world is divided into people who are with us and people who are against us, that anyone who disagrees with us or the leader of our party, in this case, Donald Trump, who, you know, is the one who is right all the time, they are to be called out. And they're to be called out in a way that is meant to be delegitimizing and diminishing. Mm-hmm. And that's by using labels like Marxist, even demonic, Luciferian, you know, using these very strong terms to describe pretty much anyone who disagrees with the party line.
Yeah. So this also kind of brings us to this phrase that comes up quite a bit that comes from Caleb Campbell, who we mentioned a moment ago, the pastor at Desert Springs, that we've lost the ability to, quote, suffer each other.
Yeah, it's a line that really sticks with me as well. You know, Caleb is part of a small, but I think growing network of evangelicals who are in many cases quite conservative, theologically, politically, but are really concerned about the implications of Christian nationalism for both Christianity itself and for the health of their churches and for the health of a pluralistic democratic society. And so what they're doing is they're, you know, having as many public conversations as they can to try and help evangelicals and evangelical leaders who didn't think that there were other people who were concerned about this, right? There are other people like them to recognize that this kind of disagreement and dissent within their church is happening and that it's normal and that it's okay, that it is not normal for everybody to be in lockstep about politics. And so one of the first steps has to do with normalizing some level of political disagreement within any community, and in their case, within the evangelical community.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of this comes back to the idea of even talking to people who disagree with you in the first place, which one of the things this show does really effectively, I think, is highlight how anathema that has come to seem.
It's not easy to do. And I think that my discomfort at the Freedom Night event is kind of one way of being really honest about how difficult that is, that I was shaken by the fact that I heard over and over and over that night the idea that people on the left were hell-bent on harming children.
What is happening with our children? What are they being taught?
All the DEI and all of the
porn that they're being read?
The porn type books that are in the libraries that they're requiring our kids to read.
Is it reasonable to expect people to be in community with somebody who looks them straight in the face and says, essentially, I think that you are part of a conspiracy to harm children, right? To accuse somebody who is a parent of being a sex trafficker. We can't have that level of vitriolic assumptions about one another and suffer each other in the ways that I think Caleb is saying. And so, you know, I think in a position to tell everyone, like, you're doing it wrong, and I think that I'm doing a great job at this. There's a lot of discomfort involved in that. Yeah. And there's also an extent to which we can't even get to a place where we can, quote unquote, suffer each other until we really turn down the volume on these kinds of accusations that we are lodging at each other.
Well, Dr. Ruth Bronstein is the host and executive producer of When the Wolves Came, Evangelicals Resisting Extremism, and also an associate professor of sociology at the University of Connecticut. Dr. Bronstein, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Valley is one of the biggest markets in the country for data centers. Tech firms cite the lack of natural disasters here as one of the factors that leads them to build data centers here. And as computing power, including AI, increases, many experts expect the number of data centers, both here and elsewhere, to expand. With me to talk about some of the challenges and opportunities associated with this are Phil Boas, opinion columnist with the Arizona Republic, and Elvia Diaz, the paper's editorial page editor. And Phil, you wrote a piece about this, so let me start with you. What is the significance to you of the quantity of data centers here in the Valley?
Yeah, well, what really got my attention was the State of the City address. Mayor Kate Gallego was talking about all the economic wins that Phoenix has had, you know, things like the $165 billion investment in microchip production and the bioscience sector. And the United Food International has just put their headquarters in Phoenix. And she was talking about their advanced robotics. And then she got to data center and really started to knock down data centers. She said they produce a lot of heat and noise. They produce paltry numbers of jobs. And they're a big drain on power and other resources. And the reason that got my attention is that Phoenix is one of the world leaders in data centers. And data centers are pretty essential to everything we do. In fact, the State of the City address, I could probably come up with 100 ways in which data centers were used to create that event and make that happen.
Elvia, data centers obviously a very big part of the Valley's economy and, you know, making the Valley's, you know, a lot of leaders want to make it sort of a tech hub. But they do tend to, as Phil pointed out, they do tend to use up a lot of resources, namely power and water.
And that's the most important thing that I'm paying attention here. In the same column, Phil is quoting Gallego saying that, you know, more than 90% of utilities' prospective queue of new industrial electricity use is made up of one kind of users: data center. In other words, they are taking so much of our resources of electricity. And to do that, we need, or the data centers need, a lot of water. I'm looking at the fact that Arizona doesn't have a lot of water. And we had been, writing about that and paying attention to that. So yes, we want of the industrial revolution here in that sense, you know, in the tech sector right now, but we have to be careful with how we manage our water. And I think the mayor is making sense to me anyway. Why is Phoenix needs to be the one carrying the burden of all those data centers, or Arizona for that matter?
So Phil, does it seem as though there needs to be some kind of balance, do you think, here between having the kind of economic development and other benefits that data centers bring, while also maybe being mindful of the natural resources that they use?
Yeah, well, I think the people that are building data centers care a lot about green energy and renewables. And a point that Sandra Watson, who is the president and CEO of the State Commerce Authority, has made is that they are putting in the kinds of investments that can help build renewable infrastructure for the future, things like solar. In Mesa, for instance, they're creating a water system where they hope to be contributing by 2030 more water to the system than they're taking in. So there is that sense within the tech industry that they're going to have to be sustainable in the future. But here's what we have to understand in Arizona. In our past, we have faced far greater scarcity when it comes to water, when it comes to electricity, and we had to do things about it in order to grow. And so we pushed for and got built things like Roosevelt Dam and the Central Arizona Project, things like that, and made it possible. The we're looking at an industrial revolution in the United States and across the world, even that's on par with what happened after World War II. There's going to be a massive need for much, much more electricity, and data centers are only a part of that. We're going to have to be building the infrastructure for that to make it happen. In fact, Ted Geisler, who's the president of APS, said in a GPEC roundtable about a year and a half ago that the Arizona electric grid is going to need to double in size over the next 15 years. That's an amazing number. And there are so many things that are contributing to that. And they're just very quickly, electric vehicles, the computing demands, such as data centers, but also artificial intelligence is mm-hmm. going to push that. And then industrial reshoring and just Arizona's population growth.
So, Phil, do you think that there's maybe a chance here that data centers could in some way be a catalyst for change, a catalyst for innovation in terms of maybe using more renewable energy or more sustainable water practices?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is Sandra Watson's point, is that these firms and the investments they're making are going to help us build the infrastructure for renewables into the future. The other point she made that is important is that the companies that are building these, you may have heard of them, Amazon, American Express, Apple, Google, Meta, Microsoft, Oracle, PayPal. These are the titans of high tech. And by doing this and partnering with them, we're building a relationship with the people that are building the modern economy. And that has real benefits for Arizona moving forward.
Elvia, let me ask you about that, because as Phil points out, there are a lot of big tech companies that are looking to have a relationship with Arizona. Is this a way that maybe the state could be pushing for more renewable energy or different, maybe more innovative water use practices, using data centers as a way to achieve that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Phil is talking about the Roosevelt Dam. I mean, when was the last time we built one of those? And when was the last time that we built the Central Arizona Project? We're talking many, many, many years ago. So yes, and we need to be building that kind of infrastructure. That's what the mayor is talking about. Like, not totally against data centers, but let's build the infrastructure that that Phil is talking about before they come, you know, sort of what developers do right now. If you're going to build a bunch of homes, you have to prove that you have enough water to do it. Well, that should be applied to data centers as well. And yes, maybe people are going to be very creative in doing so. But we need to do it. We can't just let them do whatever they want and take our energy for, not just for Arizona. This is for the rest of the nation.
Interesting. All right, guys, we'll have to leave it there. Phil Boas, opinion columnist with the Arizona Republic. Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor for the Republic. Thanks to you both. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. With Ukraine launching a significant attack on Russian targets over the weekend, tensions are once again running high as the two sides return to the negotiating table in an attempt to find a resolution to the long-running war. Joining us now with the latest is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. And Rob, the first round of talks between Russia and Ukraine didn't yield much in the way of significant progress. Any hope for this round?
There's not much hope has been attached to these because the Russians have not come forward with their kind of conditions for the talks, whereas the Ukrainians did. They said, you know, we want a full and lasting ceasefire, but they didn't get the same sort of a list of conditions, if you like, from the Russians. And that would explain why the very latest news out of Istanbul is that these talks have been fairly short-lived and that we are only likely to see another prisoner swap organized, which is what we saw from the first of these talks. Now, just looking here in Britain, Britain has sort of realized, along with various other European countries, that its defenses need to be strengthened in the face of this aggression from Russia in Ukraine. You know, there's a general feeling in Europe that it's not going to stop at Ukraine. Well, now Britain has joined in, as it were. So it's talking about paying for 12 new nuclear-powered submarines, for example, six big munitions factories across the country to produce drones and missiles, putting the country on a kind of war footing. So Britain now saying it's going to spend a lot more on defense and quickly, and this follows Germany saying something very similar under its new leader, who, by the way, visits the White House and Donald Trump this week. So a lot is going on the Russian-Ukrainian front, and the ramifications of what's happening there are definitely being felt and heard and seen across Europe in particular.
Yes, well, speaking of defense, Rob, Asia's biggest defense summit has been going on in Singapore. And this year it's been very noticeable in particular because of speeches by the American Defense Secretary and his Australian counterpart. What is being said, Rob, and what has been the reaction?
Yes, well, this has been another big story over the weekend, which is making waves, if you like, into this week that we're in now. So we saw Pete Hegseth, U.S. Defense Secretary, making a speech in Singapore. This was at a two-day event called the Shangri-La Dialogue, which is basically Asia's top defense summit, happens every year. But this year, we really saw some strong language from the Americans aimed at China and worrying about China's relationship with Taiwan. Now, Taiwan is that island off mainland China, which China regards as its territory. It sees it as a renegade province that will one day be reunited with mainland China. So there is fear, of course, that the Chinese will invade that island. And that has been very much underlined by Mr. Hegseth's comments. He said that a Chinese invasion of Taiwan could be imminent. And he referred to a 2027 deadline that President Xi Jinping of China has allegedly given for China's military to be capable of invading Taiwan. So this was the nature of that speech and some very strong language aimed at China. The Chinese embassy in response said his speech was full of smears and provocations. Without mentioning Taiwan, China said the U.S. was actually the biggest troublemaker for regional peace and stability in Asia. Examples it cited, including the U.S., quote, deploying offensive weapons in the South China Sea and conducting reconnaissance of what the embassy called Chinese islands and reefs. So quite a big sort of bust up, if you like, between the U.S. and China over what's going on there. And if you look just behind the scenes a little bit, you also hear Mr. Hegseth saying that deterrence does not come cheap. And what he's really saying there is, we need you, our Asian allies, to step up your defense spending, much as we have asked our European allies to do as well. So that was definitely reading between the lines what was also going on in that speech.
Well, finally, Rob, let's stay in Asia here, because Tuesday, tomorrow, we will see a snap election in South Korea. Why is that happening, and what should we expect?
Well, this is interesting as well. A country of 52 million people, South Korea, a major U.S. ally, of course, in Asia, as we've just been saying. South Korea will elect a new president tomorrow to replace Yoon Suk-yeol. He was removed from office for placing the country under martial law in December, just for a brief period. But it caused a real schism, if you like, in South Korean society, with about sort of, you know, half the population, if you like, supporting him and half not. And that's caused some real problems across the month. So we've seen him being impeached. We've seen him being arrested. We've seen others standing in as president who themselves have faced various issues along the way. This has rocked the South Korea's economy, and all sorts of other things have been going on. So now what we see is finally a snap election that will decide on who his successor will be. And actually, we've just looking at the latest news, we've seen there are six candidates in this election. They're crisscrossing the country trying to gain last-minute support ahead of this snap election. But what it really means is South Korea will hopefully return to some kind of stability with a new president in charge in that country from Wednesday of this week after the snap election tomorrow. So that's what this story is really hinged on.
Well, lots to keep an eye on here, particularly in the next couple of days. The BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones keeping us in the loop as always. Rob, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Tanya Katan is big on creativity in all aspects of our lives. She's the author of the 2019 book, Creative Trespassing, How to Put the Joy and Spark Back into Your Work and Life, in addition to being a public speaker, among other roles. Clearly, though, a lot has changed over those years, from the pandemic and work from home to the increased use of artificial intelligence. The book is getting a reprint, so we wanted to check back in with Katan to see how she views some of those differences. So, Tanya, let's start with COVID, and given the fragmentation of how and where we work and have worked since the pandemic, how has that changed how we see work and how we're able to be creative and find joy at work?
Well, I think before the pandemic, for example, where we now have dispersed and hybrid and remote, creativity was sort of a nice to have, right? Everybody said, oh, creativity is great. And they had vinyl letters on the wall that said, be innovative. And yet it was the first thing to kind of go away. But what happens now in this moment is that creativity is not a nice to have, it's a necessity. It's really the foundation for any kind of innovation. And also what we're finding is that people who are working from home are happier.
Well, so how do you find that that is maybe changing how we as workers think about creativity? Because, you know, you have the same people who maybe were operating under a nice to have kind of mentality. Now those same workers in many ways need to bring creativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that I write about in Creative Trespassing and I talk about in companies from Expedia to Cisco is that we have to stop waiting for inspiration. We have to stop waiting for permission to be creative. Mm. And we actually have to start asking what if questions. And so that's a tool I give everyone, which is the possibility that lies beyond this space and time. So what if instead of Zoom being this sort of like crappy one-inch by one-inch thumbnail of people, it's actually a portal to see people in who more clearly and deeper and really connect with them? And what if I launched a marketing campaign in outer space? And what if allows for possibilities beyond this time and space, beyond any form, beyond an office, beyond buildings? So that's a way in which people can start who haven't felt comfortable engaging in a creative process or practice, start it. What if?
Do you find that people are hesitant to do that?
I'm laughing because I think that if we have not trained or practiced something, of course we're hesitant to do it. It would be like, Mark, if you're like, Tanya, you know what? Would you be hesitant to run a marathon tomorrow? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, I am. And so that's another thing that I help people do, again, in the book and also in real life, which is do one thing as opposed to no things or nothing. So small incremental steps every day lead to something. So for example, with creativity, if we decide to practice it at work, and creativity, just for everybody's listening, there's two kinds, the big C, I'm a playwright, I'm a choreographer, and the little C, which everyone has. We're all born with the little C, which is our ability to come up with infinite solutions, ideas, and innovations to any single problem. We all have it. So creativity, solutions to problems that exist. Let's say their problem is I and my colleagues who work really hard haven't gotten a raise in years. What if I raised my hand during the next meeting? That's an act of creativity. And what if I asked for a raise? And what if I spoke up? And da-da-da. But it doesn't all happen at once. So one thing over time adds up to something significant.
It's interesting because I think for a lot of workers and a lot of people, like raising their hand and asking for a raise would not be seen as an act of creativity. It would be seen maybe as an act of something else, but not creativity. So I wonder if there's maybe a mentality shift that, or maybe just a creative way of thinking about things that people have to undertake here.
Yeah, it's a whole reframe, but it's a reframe. It's not like a reconstruction of reality. It's looking at reality. So, for example, in the title of my book is joy. Mm-hmm. And people are like, joy at work? That's crazy. So when I was working at a company, I actually left my desk to do my job. I would interview people and make silly videos and all of these things. And at some point, the board of directors said, Tanya's not working. She's just running around having fun. And I showed the return on investment of my running around having fun, the metrics. I could qualify and quantify it. And when I could do that, what we realized together is that work and fun aren't mutually exclusive.
Well, so what's the balance, though? Because I would imagine there are a lot of bosses who would not be thrilled if their workers are just like sitting at their desk doodling all day, while the workers might be having a great time doing it or playing video games or any number, you know, watching Netflix or whatever. Like, what's the balance between finding that fun and, as you referenced, being able to still say, no, I'm having fun, but I'm also being productive. I'm also doing my job here.
Yeah, well, here's the deal. I kind of disagree with anybody who would think that somebody who's doodling or playing video games is not doing their job. And so the point is—
But if they're doing it all day, for example.
So listen, hey, here's how I feel about it. I could go for a walk all day. I could have conversation with friends. I could just play pinball, whatever I want. And if at the end of the day, I'm serving the mission, vision, and values of the company for which I've chosen to work with, and I meet all of the objectives and goals set by me and my boss, who cares? I'm being sincere.
It sounds like it's about, like, communication and expectations here.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, actually, I was just working with a local tech company, a startup that I helped them start mm-hmm. up and then go to market. And their whole thing was about how do we agree as a group, no matter where you are in the hierarchy, that this is our collective objective and these are our collective goals. And how you get there, I don't care. But if we agree that we're going to get there any way you want. And to answer your question more honestly and less snarkily, you know, any leader I've worked with at Fortune 500 companies or big tech companies who are worth their weight in anything, give their employees a playbook, not a script.
So what role do you find that artificial intelligence is playing in all of this?
Ooh, AI. Ooh, creepy.
You know we had to get there eventually.
I know. Okay, here's the deal. AI is a great tool. I was an early adopter of ChatGPT. It is, it sees patterns. It allows you to kind of put some input and then it generates an idea. I think it's a good first drafter for maybe a proposal and things like that. But what AI doesn't have is it does not have the ability to ask more human, connected, and empathetic questions. Mm. So it's our job to double down on our humanity and find ways to engage with it. Otherwise, it will wield us as opposed to us wielding it.
Well, so it sounds like what you're saying is use ChatGPT as a tool in your process, as a part of your process, maybe even a prompt, but don't use it to write your speech. Don't use it to do the entire project, whatever that project might be.
Unless you have trained it for years and years and years because it has not been around.
Yeah.
And look, I, again, early adopter of ChatGPT, I have trained it to kind of like understand my voice, my tone, my focus. And still, at the end of the day, it is not creative. It will not generate something that you're like proud to bring on stage. If it is an embodied experience, I hate to tell you, but us squishy human bodies need to do it first. It's just responding to us. It's not generating something that didn't exist before. It didn't exist before we said it existed. So I would double down on HI, not AI, human ingenuity. What? I said it.
Wow.
Hi. Because that's the reality. That's why we are in this world. And that's why we created this weird, wily thing that can be helpful. And also AI is awesome at efficiency. Let it do it faster. Who cares? But you take the time to write the poem or the book or the play or the love letter.
All right. Well, Tanya Catan, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For the always creative Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.